tonight, I'd like to continue my remarks about the age of the solar system and the age of the Earth that I had started in the previous lecture. I've already mentioned the importance of this study. If we can establish that things are young, if this happens to be the case, then the evolutionist certainly is wrong about the whole thing. He has a monster that feeds on huge amounts of time, feeds on literally millions and millions of years. And without all of that time, the evolutionist certainly cannot establish his position. So what I'd like to do is take a look at some things about the solar system itself that seem to indicate a young age for things. There are quite a number of arguments that one can cite from a study of solar system astronomy that would indicate a young age for things. And when I say a young age, I mean on the order of just thousands of years, not tens of thousands of years, nor hundreds of thousands of years, or millions of years, or billions, anything of the sort, but something quite small. Now, you need to keep in mind that for some reason or other, to a lot of people it is an unpalatable thing philosophically to think that something could happen in a short period of time. It bothers them no end that rates perhaps might act at a very fast rate, that there might be a huge amount of energy involved, and things could happen rather suddenly. People, it seems, for some reason or other, I don't know why for sure, they seem to prefer to think that everything goes along very, very slowly, you know, and happens very, very gradually. And I think a lot of this, the reason for it is people have been so conditioned to think in the manner that the uniformitarians urge us to think, a little trickle of water here, a little bit of wind there, a little sleet, a little snow now and then, and everything, you know, acting very, very gradually. Of course, if these people lived in Florida or down along the Gulf Coast, you know, where a hurricane can bring in a day or two 100 years worth of geomorphic activity, perhaps they would change their mind, you know, about rates and whether things always act in a nice uniform fashion. But some people, of course, have the feeling that no matter what you say against the ideas of evolution, if the evolutionist is right about time, well, he must be right some way or other. This is their intuitive feeling about the matter. Well, I don't believe he is right on this age question. And let's take a look at some of the arguments. Some of them are standard arguments that I could cite, and I hope to throw in a few new ones that maybe you haven't heard of in regard to things being young. Let's take a very simple one, and one that an argument that has been cited for quite a number of years, and this has to do with what is called the influx of cosmic dust on the Earth and on the Moon. You know, if you get out at night and you take a look at the sky, you know, you see things called falling stars or shooting stars, what the astronomer calls a meteor traveling through the sky, which is just a trail of light. This trail of light, you know, is caused when a small chunk of rock or dust, or the chunk of rock or dust is about the size of a grain of sand that you pick up on the desert floor. You know, it comes into the atmosphere of the Earth, impacts with the atmosphere of the Earth at a very, very high velocity, about 30 kilometers per second, or 19 miles per second, hits, you know, particles in the upper atmosphere, knocks electrons loose from their parent atoms, or nuclei of those atoms, and when they return to those parents, they give up that energy they had acquired through those collisions as light energy. And the thing that you're seeing in the sky is not the meteor itself, or the meteorite, or the meteoroid, whatever you want to call it, that is burning up. You're seeing the light, or the particles in the upper atmosphere that are excited, and in their excitation, emitting light as they return to a less excited state. And you're seeing the trail of light that is formed. You couldn't see that little chunk of rock burning up. Now, it does burn up, but you couldn't see it at a height of 60 miles above the surface of the Earth at all, considering its size. But anyhow, this material is burned up very rapidly, doesn't reach the surface of the Earth at all. But now and then, large enough objects do enter the Earth's atmosphere, survive a trip through the atmosphere, you see, without being consumed, and eventually reach the surface of the Earth, impact with the surface of the Earth, and form craters. And if the thing survives that trip, and you can pick up chunks of the material, this is referred to as a meteorite. And there are a lot of meteorites that hit the surface of the Earth and eventually add to the mass of the Earth. Quite a great deal, as a matter of fact. Now, studies of those objects are extremely important, certainly it's important to study crater-forming meteorites if you happen to be in the way of one. It's too bad. No need to ride home. It'll be too late. You've seen such craters as the one at Canyon Diablo up in Arizona above Sedona, and you've read stories of how meteorite craters are formed and so forth. These are very important studies, but they're not what I'm interested in this morning. From just about the beginning of modern studies in astronomy, the astronomers always believe that just as there are very large objects that are impacting with the Earth's atmosphere and eventually perhaps with the surface of the Earth, there are very small objects at the opposite extreme that are entering the Earth's atmosphere and eventually reaching the surface. Now, these objects are referred to as micrometeorites or cosmic dust, as the Russian astronomers have always called that material. And this cosmic dust is believed to be on the order of magnitude of about a few ten-thousandth of a centimeter. These particles, about a few ten-thousandth of a centimeter in diameter, around four ten-thousandths to pick a sort of a good figure that would fit a lot of them, an average value. These little chunks of rock, as you can see, are very small. Being that small, they're microscopic in size, and you can't see one. You know, if you picked one up, you wouldn't even know you'd picked it up. You have to have quite a number of them before you see them, or you have to look at them under a microscope to actually see them. Some people have doubted their existence. But astronomers from the beginning just about have believed that this material exists in great quantities in between the planets and the sun. And as the Earth swings around and around in its orbit, it intercepts this material, you see. These particles are very, very small, these chunks of rock. They enter the Earth's atmosphere and don't burn up because of the ratio between their mass and their surface area being radically different than what it is for large chunks of rock or meteoric material. They travel with very large velocities through the atmosphere, but they're not consumed, and it's believed that they eventually reach the surface of the Earth. Now, studies have been going on for quite a long time to try to decide how much of this material is entering the Earth's atmosphere per year and eventually reaching the surface of the Earth. I guess the first studies were made by a man by the name of Bud Hume out at the California Institute of Technology back in the 30s. He made a study of the influx of this material, and the way he did it was a standard practice until very recent times on deciding how much of this material is coming in on the surface of the Earth. He'd take out a tray, say a square foot, you know, in surface area. Pick one that's a foot by a foot. That means your calculations are very simple. 1 foot by 1 foot gives you a surface area of 1 square foot. It's always easy to multiply and divide by one. Take a tray out about like that, fill it with a chemical that's rather sticky, but doesn't evaporate so readily in sunlight, and leave it sitting out there about a week, and you know, if this stuff is drifting down through the atmosphere very gradually, very slowly, in a week you'll pick up so much of this material. You'll probably pick up a lot of other things in that sticky chemical as well. I've done this myself when I first went down to the University of Texas at El Paso, then called Texas Western College. I worked on this a while, tried it for a while myself. Well, you take that chemical tray in, you go out and get it in about a week. The professor always reserves that for himself. Lets the graduate students do the hard work. You go out, pick up the tray, bring it in, get rid of the chemical. You know, that leaves a residue of material in there ordinarily. Then, the way Bud Hugh would do it, he'd take a magnet and just pull out the magnetic material and leave the rest, throw it away. Because in the 30s, they believed that meteoric material was mainly magnetic. Well, that's not so. And today it is known that most of your meteoric material is stony in nature, and just a small percentage of it is composed of iron, for instance. So he would take a magnet, pull out the magnetic material, and then put that under a microscope. And you see these little chunks of rock, as they enter the Earth's atmosphere, they get shaped due to friction between the atmosphere and the chunk of rock itself, as the piece, you know, moves down through the atmosphere, and they are made roughly spherical in shape, and they're called cosmic spherules then. So you look at those things under a microscope, and things that are roughly spherical in shape, you keep, the rest you throw away. So you've thrown away, really, probably most of the meteoric material, but you've got some left. So Bud Hugh then would weigh that and come to a conclusion then. You had so many grams, let's say, of it. You ordinarily don't get grams of it. You get fractions of a gram and so forth. Down in 1 week on a square foot, multiply that by the number of weeks in a year, and you got the amount coming down on a square foot in 1 year. Multiply that by the number of square feet that make up the surface of the earth, and you have the total amount then that's reaching the surface of the earth in 1 year. You have the influx rate then of the cosmic dust or the micrometeoric material. That's how it's done roughly. Different people have tried this. A man with the name of Crozier up at the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology. They changed their name recently, but that's what it used to be called. That's cool. He used to do this quite a great deal. As I say, I tried it for a while. I wore out too many graduate students and finally had to give it up. You know, all that looking under the microscope wears everybody out. You have to examine the stuff under a microscope, and that's enough to... I got so I couldn't hire any students. Even though I was paying the highest wages on the campus for the work, nobody wanted that microscope work. Sitting there doing that, it's a very tedious, terribly boring job, to say the least, and I don't blame them much, but it's too bad. So I finally gave up on the job. But you get a little bit of everything, of course, in those samples. One time I put one of these trays out in a volcano cone over in southeastern New Mexico, over toward Columbus, New Mexico. Thought I'd just see what would one pick up in a volcano cone. Well, you're going to pick up a lot of dust. But I got about a million insects, bugs in that. That's a slight exaggeration, perhaps. It looked like a million. When I picked up the jar of the material, it was probably a little less than a million, maybe 998,000 or something of there, 9,980, something like that. But anyhow, we picked up a little bit of everything. I did that just for fun. I didn't give that to the graduate students to work on. But the estimates have ranged quite a great deal, depending on the investigator. Bud Hugh probably has the lowest estimate. He says 10,000 tons of this material per day. On the other extreme is a German astronomer by the name of Hans Schmidt at Hanover. And Schmidt says 700,000 tons per day. 700,000 tons per day. So we see quite a great deal of range and variation of the estimates by these people. I think a good estimate, which is sort of in between the extremes, is an estimate by a man by the name of Hans Patterson, a Swedish geophysicist. He says about 14,300,000 tons per year reaches the surface of the Earth. A fellow wrote an article about me recently in the Journal of the American Scientific Affiliation, which he criticized me for using Patterson's value, but I still think Patterson's value is an excellent one. And Patterson's value still sticks very close to sort of the mean or an average of most investigators in this regard, and I think it's a very excellent value to use as an average. One could use Schmidt's value, he'd come out with a rather large figure. He could use Bud Hugh's, and he'd have a bit of a smaller value, but still it's not going to affect the arguments, particularly one way or the other. But anyhow, Asimov, you know, the science fiction writer, who at one time was a professor, biochemistry professor, you know, at the University of Pittsburgh, made a lot more money writing science fiction than he ever thought about otherwise. But anyhow, he wrote a little paper on this. Anybody can make the calculations. But he calculated that if you use Patterson's value and you take the age of the Earth as 4.5 billion years, you ought to have a layer of this dust about 54 feet in thickness after 4.5 billion years. In other words, we'd be drowning in this dust on the surface of the Earth. Of course, everybody says you can't see this dust. Apparently, there's none of it around. Well, one doesn't know whether there's any on the floor or not, since it's microscopic in size. When I first talked about these arguments at the first college I taught at, which was many, many years ago, you know that old commercial, or they laughed when I sat down to play the piano? You know, somebody had a commercial for piano lessons, and yeah, this fellow saying that they laughed when I sat down to play the piano. Well, they all laughed when I put forth that argument. The theology department all laughed, and I was a bit heretical. I had said, you know, things were young. They were rather upset about that. This was a church-related school, and they didn't like that idea of a young age for things. And So they all laughed when I got up to mention this cosmic dust. And they said, oh, you mean the stuff we sweep up off the floor? The janitor sweeps up is cosmic dust. Well, he who laughs last, laughs best, of course, in all of this matter. And I don't remember what I answered. I hope I gave a witty answer. Probably not. One never thinks of something smart to say when he's up. He always thinks of it about an hour later after it's too late to reply. But anyhow, probably some of it was cosmic dust for that matter. But anyhow, there's supposed to be 54 feet of this in thickness. Of course, it is not there. And the standard answer as to where it's gone, and I would agree with the standard answer, is that there are erosional agents on the surface of the earth, and this material is continually, you see, swept down by the rain, the water, and all of that, the wind, into the oceans. And there is probably where this cosmic dust is. And I'd certainly agree with that position. That's more than likely where it is. So what we should do is go out there and look for it in the oceans. Now, what we should do is, if we're going to try to use this as to get some idea as to the age of things, we should pick some chemical element in that cosmic dust and use it as an indicator. You know, if we can pick some element that's fairly common in that material, but not so common in the earth itself, in the crustal rocks of the earth, then we would have an indicator of perhaps the age of the oceans. And if we have an indication of the age of the oceans, we have a good indication of the age of the planet itself, since most geologists believe the oceans, ocean basins, are about the same age as the earth itself. But regardless, you're going to have an upper limit on the age of things, depending on how much, say, of some element you have in the water. For instance, you see, if you pick nickel, all you need to do then is find out how much nickel you've got in cosmic dust, how much is coming in per year, measure the amount of nickel that's in the oceans, and then divide one by the other and get the length of time it would take to accumulate that much nickel in the ocean water. So, nickel is fairly common in cosmic dust and meteoric material, and it's we're not running over with nickel here on the Earth. Relatively speaking, it's rare, but there's still a lot of it, and seemingly plenty for industrial needs and whatnot. If you pick nickel, and you calculate the amount of nickel that's in the ocean water by bringing up samples, you know, which have been done countless times now, and you determine the amount of nickel that is coming in per year in cosmic dust, you find that you could accumulate practically all of nickel in about 8,000 years. If you look at the problem on the basis of the runoff from the rocks, you see, that make up the continents, forgetting about this influx of cosmic dust, and by the way, you can find this calculation in any typical, well, in a fairly good geology textbook, one called The Earth, which is a fairly recent one, written by a whole slew of professors at the University of California at Berkeley, the principal author being a geologist with the name of Verhoeven. In that book, they have a chapter on the chemical elements in the oceans. And in there, and I'll just cite their calculation, they say that in about 8,200 years, you could accumulate all of the nickel that you have in ocean water from just runoff. So you have two sources of the nickel. One would be the runoff from the continents, see where the water, the rocks are dissolved and so forth, and the nickel is in solution. Of course, you're going to have, if all of that cosmic dust is being washed down into the oceans, you're having part of that cosmic dust coming from runoff, and then you're having, you see, the rain, the cosmic rain, so to speak, settling down over the oceans themselves. But anyhow, if you break the problem into two parts, you get about the same figure either way you calculate it. In other words, you can accumulate all of that nickel in about 8,000 years at the very most. Now, what I'm getting at is this. That gives you an age of the oceans, unless you can figure out a way to get rid of the nickel, you know. Well, a lot of people have worked on this problem, and this has been recognized as a dilemma before. Why do you have only 8,000 years worth of nickel if you've got all this cosmic dust pouring in? You've got runoff from the continental masses if things have been around for 4.5 billion years. You ought to have a lot more nickel down there than you've got. Well, there have been a number of attempts at answering this. One time I gave this lecture, or one similar to it, in London, and a chemist, a surface chemist, whatever one of those kind are, said he's a surface chemist. I didn't know for sure what that meant, but anyhow, he said, you're missing the boat badly. Because you won't find that nickel in the ocean water, it precipitates out into the sediments. you know, at the bottom of the ocean. Well, I'm not a chemist at all, by any stretch. I hated every day of chemistry. And I took it as a freshman a long time ago. Those labs, man, gave me a headache every time. I always go in from chemistry lab with a splitting headache, to say the least. But anyhow, I decided to check on that, and he's right. It's hard to dissolve nickel. But I also took a look in Brian Mason's Principles of Geochemistry, and Mason said he thought it was unlikely that the nickel precipitated out. Well, it doesn't make any difference. Let's just take a look at the deep sea sediments and see. That's proof of the pudding is in the tasting. Isn't that where the saying goes or something like that? Well, let's just take a look at the sediments and see if it's there. That's the thing to do. Then we don't have to worry about whether it does precipitate out or doesn't precipitate out or who's right. And I haven't the slightest idea who's right in regard to it, except when you do look at the sediments, you find you've got about the same concentration in the sediments so far as the accumulation is concerned, time-wise, as you would have for the ocean water itself. In other words, you're not running over nickel down the deep sea sediments. You just have about several thousand years worth of nickel in the deep sea sediments. You don't have hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or billions or millions of years worth of accumulation of nickel in the deep sea sediments. Now, I know you have these nodules that have nickel on the bottom of the ocean, but still, this is not accumulating billions of years worth of nickel. There's not that much nickel down in the deep sea sediments, if you can believe the core samples and the samples that are dredged up off the ocean bottom from those sediments. If you can believe that, then you have just a few thousand, several thousand, depends on what you mean by few or several. I mean by several, I mean larger than 5,000. Few, I mean 5,000 or less years worth. So you have, again, about the same order of magnitude, time-wise, so far as the accumulation of nickel is concerned, in the deep sea sediments. And Mason himself pointed out something very significant. He says when you get those cosmic spherules out of deep sea sediments, he says there is not much of it there. And he says the distribution of the sizes of those chunks of meteoric material would indicate that they're mainly ablation products. You know, this material is swept off the surface of these meteors as they move through the atmosphere due to the heating of the meteor. He says they're irregular in shape and they are larger in size, ordinarily, than the cosmic spherules. And he made the statement that cosmic spherules are virtually absent in the deep sea sediments. Now, when one of these fellows say virtually absent, they mean they're there all right, but there's nowhere approaching the amount that you should have there, you see, 4.5 billion years worth. So he says they're virtually absent, which means you just got a handful when you all have loads and loads of this stuff present in the deep sea sediments. Some people say they're down the trenches, all that nickel's down the trenches. Well, they've dredged up sediments out of the various trenches on the ocean bottom, and it's not there. Some people say you have the ocean plates, quotation marks, these are the continental drift people, plate tectonic people. They say you got plates being pushed under continents, and all of that nickel and stuff is going right under the continents. Well, in the first place, I have a hard time understanding how you can slide rocks which have a rigidity of that of steel, you know, under rocks that have a similar rigidity and keep everything coherent, you know. I have a hard time with these sliding plates. Physics of it bothers me considerably, how you slide these big plates around, but geologists can always slide things around without much difficulty. They don't worry about the physics of it, but you see, you'd have tremendous frictional forces and viscosities existing between the crust and the mantle. You start trying to slide these plates around, you're going to have a tremendous forces that you have to move these plates against, and then they're saying you slide them right under the continents. That's enough to make a fellow's hair stand straight up nearly, you know, hearing about things like that without hearing about an energy source that can do these sort of things. Listen, you just can't do things like that without energy to do it. Just because it sounds good doesn't mean that's what happens. Well, anyhow, I don't see how you slide those sediments under the continents, because the sediments, relatively speaking, are going to be what? Soft, compared to basement rock. How in the world are you going to scoop soft rock underneath hard rock, you see, without destroying it? And how are you going to get it all under there? Well, they work all sorts of miracles on sliding these things around. But anyhow, the sediments don't show the presence of that nickel. In other words, you've only got about 8,000 years worth of nickel period. And this seems to me to indicate that the Earth must be quite young, because you ought to have, listen, if you've got 54 feet of this stuff all over the surface of the Earth and it washed down the oceans, you're going to have a lot of nickel down there out of all that. Calculate it for yourself. Well, some people still don't like that argument. I don't know why. I'm very biased, of course, but it seems perfectly obvious to me. Well, let's go, though, to a place where we've not got any erosion, since everybody worries about the erosion. Listen, I don't care how much erosion you got. Water moves downhill, doesn't it? It's got to end up in the oceans. Those are the low points on the globe. The ocean basins are the deep places. Talk about erosion or not, stuff's got to end up down the low points and the low places. So all you have to do eventually is look what? At the lower altitudes, there you've got everything. Because everything what? Washes down. If water flows downhill, it won't flow uphill unless you've got enough energy to make it flow uphill. So eventually everything's got to be down the ocean sooner or later. So that's the ideal place to look, all right. But anyhow, let's go out to an object that has no erosional agents associated with it. Let's take a look at the moon. There, nothing to erode anything away except tremendous radiation, which is coming in. But no rain, no snow, no oceans, no streams flowing around. And the moon is only, on an average, 250,000 miles from the Earth and should sweep through about the same region of space that we do, and therefore should sweep through about the same density of this interplanetary material as the moon moves in its orbit about the Earth and as the Earth drags it along as it swings around the sun. So if we look at the moon there, we ought to be able to make a clear-cut decision. No erosion or anything of that sort. No way to get rid of anything that comes and lands on top of the moon unless it bounces off. So, let's take a look at the moon. We ought to have about, relatively speaking, we'll have about the same thickness of material there on the surface. We ought to have plenty of that material on the surface of the moon, because there's been no atmosphere at all on the moon to destroy any of this, you know, influxing material. And so it ought to land there, settle down. You ought to have a nice layer of this stuff on the moon. Now, when I was a student, an undergraduate student, it was believed without a doubt that there was a huge layer of this dust on the moon. Today you see denials of this, that people believe that. Well, I don't care what these people want to deny. All you have to do is go back and read the handful of textbooks written back then, and you'll find out that certainly everybody believed there was a huge layer of dust on the moon. There weren't many textbooks written in those days on astronomy. There's just a handful, so it's easy finding if you want to find out about that layer of dust. It was believed, without a doubt, that there was a huge layer of dust on the moon. And when Wernher von Braun was proposing, you know, a trip to the moon, trying to persuade the army to let him send a rocket to the moon, and he wouldn't send a man with that rocket, it was pointed out that if a man were sent along in the rocket, he wouldn't be coming back. You know, the rocket would land on the moon, thing would sit right down in that big layer of dust, and it would have to stay there. Because, you know, with a layer roughly 50-some feet in thickness, a big rocket weighing hundreds of tons would settle down there, you know, just sink right down in that dry mud hole, so to speak, and couldn't get back out. And if a fellow went to the moon, might as well figure on staying. His stay would be short, but nonetheless, he would just have to plan on staying there. You'd have to get somebody who wanted to escape this veil of tears, so to speak, and wasn't really wanting to come back, particularly if you sent a man along. And of course, as pointed out to von Braun, there'd be no chance of sending a man. Just have to send a payload of instruments to make the measurements. Everybody believed there was that layer of dust on the moon in those days. There was a book published just a few years ago called Planets and Moons, written by William Hartman, who was a consultant for NASA during these moonshots. He was associated with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at Caltech. Hartman in this book pointed this out. He said, we spent literally billions of dollars of the taxpayers' money trying to make a decision about that layer of dust on the moon before we ever decided to send a man to the moon. He said, we were all convinced there was that layer, but he said the photographs from high-altitude rockets and balloons were seemingly indicating that maybe there was some doubt as to whether that layer of dust existed or not. The albedo of the moon, the light, the intensity of it, the wavelengths and so forth that were being reflected off the surface seemed to indicate that maybe the layer of dust did not exist. Though, if one reasoned it out, it had to be there. After all, 4.5 billion years worth of time with this stuff pouring in is bound to give you a layer of dust there, tremendously thick. So he said everybody believed it should be there, but yet these photographs were indicating that maybe it was not there. And he said we put a number of rockets around the moon to try to make a decision. Now, for all of those who deny that, and an astronomer wrote in, he read one of my articles somewhere where I had mentioned this, and he said I was dead wrong, they never believed that. Well, I'm not dead wrong, and there's Hartman, who was, as I say, a consultant for NASA, and he has it right there plainly. This fellow must have graduated so recently he never heard any old ideas. I go back to the Dark Ages in astronomy, of course. But they certainly did believe there was that layer of dust, and Hartman verifies it so beautifully. He said it this way. He said, we spent billions of dollars of the taxpayers' money to make a decision about that. I don't care what this character says. Nobody believes it. Certainly did believe it. It was there. Well, you remember they had, and I must tell this, I've told it before, but I must tell it again because it's such a good statement, really. They had Dr. Harold Urey, very famous, you know, for his work on the origin of the solar system, very famous for his work on the origin of life. And, by the way, I lectured at a East Lansing Community College in Lansing, Michigan, some years ago. I gave a lecture there. They were having a series of lectures for a class in which they had scientists of opposing viewpoints lecturing. Dr. Urey preceded me by a month, and he had made the statement that evolution was a law on the same level of evidence that gravity was a law. Have you ever heard a more incredible, fantastic statement as that in your life? Well, you may have, but that one certainly is going to rank with all of the most incredible statements. Surely that'll be a close runner-up if you heard one more fantastic than that. Why, all you have to do is step off, you know, just let yourself fall over one of these steps right here, and you know that gravity exists. But my goodness, there's not a shred of experimental proof that organic evolution is an explanation of anything. It's no alternative to anything because there is no evidence for it. I must make this remark. This is free. You know, you keep hearing that evolution is an alternative. And I heard it stated that it was a viable alternative. I assume by that word viable, I'll have to look that up in the dictionary to be sure. But I believe that means a living alternative, one that's alive and kicking. It may be an alternative, but it's certainly not a living one. Listen, if you don't have a shred of evidence for something, and it is in contradiction to basic experiment laws established by experiment and observation, like the second law of thermodynamics and so forth, it's no living alternative. It's an alternative that somebody's dreamed of. They've been having life in it. It's a dead horse. And nothing else. It's no alternative explanation. It's based on something that is contradictory to the evidence. And something that's contradictory to the evidence, then, it's not a viable alternative. All right, meanwhile, back at the ranch, where I left off. That was an editorial thrown in there. But I keep hearing this alternative stuff. I must say that. I keep hearing all this alternative business. Listen, something that has no truth associated with it, not an alternative, not a living one. Something somebody dreams up, but it has nothing to do with truth, and that's what scientists say, you know, they're doing. We take that oath, you know, when we graduate, we promise to always search for the truth and never hide it or twist it in any way and so forth and whatnot. Well, anyhow, then, whatever I was talking about before I got off on that, back to Harold Urey, yes. Well, they had Dr. Urey on television. You know, right before they had one of these, we're going to let a rocket impact with the surface of the moon, and one of these commentators, I've forgotten which network it was, he said, Dr. Urey, in about an hour, this rocket will hit the surface of the moon. What do you think it's going to be like? Is it going to hit a big soft cushion, you know, that big layer of dust there on the surface, or is it going to hit mainly solid rock? Dr. Urey used all of that proper scientific caution, which is admirable in scientists. He said, well, we really don't know that much about the surface of the moon. I don't want to say. I don't blame him a bit. I certainly don't blame him. I wouldn't want to say either. And Of course, Yuri, with all those viewers, who wanted to say the wrong thing? He said solid. It turned out as soft. Looked bad for him. There was his professorship at the University of California, San Diego. Virtue at that time was a big shot, and who in the world wants to look bad in front of a million viewers? He'd have said the opposite. If he'd gotten it right, it'd have been great, wouldn't it? It'd have looked really good. But there was a 50-50 chance, you see, he figured. And up until this time, they were convinced it was soft, but there were those disturbing photographs, you know, and measurements taken from telescopes up in rockets and balloons and so forth that were saying the logic somehow, the reasoning wasn't working right. Something was wrong because it wasn't showing what it should. You know, that's always the trouble with facts. They sometimes mess the smartest schemes up. You know, they really become a fly in the ointment. When you have to deal with facts. You didn't have to bother with the facts, it'd be great, wouldn't it? If you go back to being like Aristotle and followers of Aristotle and so forth. Aristotle wasn't really that bad. Now and then he was right, even. But, you know, things don't fall like they're in a vacuum, by the way. You know, if you drop something off a building, it doesn't fall just like it were in a vacuum because there's air resistance. He's right, really, there. But he's wrong about a lot of things. Well, anyhow, though, Yuri backed out of saying anything. And it was Will Rogers who once remarked, you folks are all so young, you know who Will Rogers was, probably. But anyhow, you're close to Oklahoma, you ought to know. He said that scientists get bigger and bigger reputations the more they talk about things you can't check on. And, of course, that's about right. That's how one gets his promotions and raises, you know, getting off on things that he can talk freely about without much chance of being checked on. But anyhow, what was the case when the first rocket impacted? Well, they decided it was solid. The indications were there from the signals sent back that the surface of the moon was solid, not soft. So they decided to send a man then. Nothing to worry about, at least as far as that rocket sinking down that layer of dust. So they sent a man. You remember the first man who walked on the moon? You remember how it was on the radio, all that talking continually. He said with his boot he could scuff through the dust to the solid rock. He said just with his boot he could scuff through the dust to the rock. Well, that was bad news at Black Rock. A bad day at Black Rock when that rocket landed. Turned out just a very, very thin veneer of that dust on the surface of the moon. After that, there was not much talk anymore about dust. You know, like there used to be in astronomy books. That dust thing was a real big thing with all astronomers. Everybody liked to speculate on how far you'd sink and all of that stuff before. But after that, everything was strangely quiet when it came to the dust matter. But, of course, if you pick up some of the reports, they still talk about thicknesses. The reports, of course, have indicated that where landings have been in different seas on the surface of the moon, you've had different quantities of dust, but you've never had anything approaching what you should have had if the evolutionist scheme of things is correct, namely that things are 4.5 to 5 billion years old, the moon being about that age. If you take a look at the data that has been collected regarding the moon, it turns out that most of the time, the thicknesses have been just small fractions of an inch. In a few places, you've had more than that, but never anything approaching 50 feet in thickness, never anything approaching 20 feet, for that matter. Nothing approaching tens of feet at all. Well, some people have come up with all sorts of answers as to where the dust might have gone, all the way from bouncing off the surface. Listen, the moon has a smaller gravitational pull than the Earth does, but nonetheless, it's still large enough to easily hold that dust on its surface. There's no danger of all that dust bouncing off. One of my students, he was having some fun. He said, there are big cracks on the moon. The dust is all down those cracks. Well, maybe so. But nobody's ever seen such a thing as that. Well, he was enjoying it. It's all right. There was another statement made about the moon, though, and I must tell you about this because this statement was made by one of the most famous of modern-day astronomers, and certainly, I think, one of the best. R.A. Littleton, a very famous British astronomer, he's also, by the way, a consultant for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory on these space shots, and still is, and he is a professor of astronomy at the Institute of Theoretical Astronomy at Cambridge University. He and Hoyle are cohorts there, by the way, and Bondine, Gold, the whole gang are there. At the Institute of Theoretical Astronomy at Cambridge. And Littleton gave a series of BBC broadcasts back in the mid-50s. And those broadcasts were so successful, they decided to take them and put them in a book form. And they published a book and called it The Modern Universe. And in it, Littleton discussed the moon. And he made a statement in there that's as good as you could get. I'm sure Littleton would love to buy up every copy if he could find them. He'd like to buy back every copy he could get his hands on after he said this later on. He said this, and I like statements like this because you can really pin them down. There's now this slight hedging leaving the door open so you can slip back out and so forth if things turn out rather badly for you. Littleton said, in addition to the accumulation of dust on the moon due to this influx of the dust from interplanetary space, he said the moon has no atmosphere, and consequently, high-energy radiation zips right on through to the surface of the moon without being slowed down any at all, as it is here on the Earth, you see, by absorption and so forth. He says it strikes the surface of the moon, breaks up those rocks, just pulverizes them, which is certainly good physics. He's right about that. And he says you should have a layer of this dust material a few 10,000ths of an inch produced per year during the lifetime of the moon. And so he went on to say, in 4.5 billion years, you ought to have a layer of dust on the moon several miles in thickness. Now, how can you beat that for a good positive statement? Several miles in thickness. He didn't say a few feet or tens of feet. He said it ought to be several miles in thickness. Well, if you take 4 10,000ths of an inch and produce per year and go back, say, 5 billion years or thereabouts, you'd get about, if I remember correctly, 32 miles of that dust. So Littleton surely wasn't teasing any when he said several miles in thickness. Well, as I say, I'm sure, I've never met Littleton, though I know of him, but I'm sure, I would feel sure, certainly if I were in his place, I'd like to get every copy of that book back so I'd get that statement out of circulation. He said plainly, he said there'd be a layer of dust several miles in thickness. And Littleton's reasoning was excellent. Just a straight physics problem to take the energy of the radiation that's coming in, what is called the strength of the rocks, and figure out how much damage you would do to the rocks, and consequently calculate about the thickness of this dust that you produce per year. So there was nothing wrong with Littleton's physics, nothing wrong with his reasoning, but the trouble was what? Was that billion that he put in there, you know, 5 billion that he stuck in the equation. It's that first billion that puts you over the mark there. He put that value for the time in there, and that's what threw things off. If he hadn't done that, he might have come out with a different value, certainly would have come out with a different value. Well, what I'm getting at is this. There's really just a very, very small quantity of dust on the surface of the moon, nothing at all remotely approaching tens of feet, nothing approaching a tenth of a mile, a quarter of a mile, half a mile, or anything of the sort. Nothing approaching what? 32 miles. Another student of mine said, well, after you get 2 or 3 miles of that stuff, then that would serve as a cushion or a blanket, you see, to prevent further breakup. And all you're going to do is just beat to death, you know, that, say, first 3 miles. Well, I don't know whether that's true or not. Maybe it is. I don't care, because you can't even scrape up what? Nothing more than about a fraction of an inch of this stuff. So it really doesn't make much difference whether that's true or not in the long run. Because, you see, you're not at all approaching anything that would give you these miles of this dust, which Littleton claimed that you should have, and I certainly think he's very right in this regard. The absence, then, of cosmic dust, with no way to replenish the supply, at least so far as one can see, on the Earth and on the Moon, would seem to indicate that both the Earth and the Moon are very, very young, rather than very, very old. Perhaps one could be like the followers of Aristotle, you know, who said that, you know, when Galileo invented the telescope, he looked at it and there were craters, and the followers of Aristotle said, that couldn't be right, because Aristotle had said the moon was perfect. You know, the presence of craters supposedly indicated some kind of imperfection. Some people associate craters and things like that with philosophical and religious ideas of perfection and imperfection and so forth, and Aristotle apparently did. And they said you couldn't be right. Galileo couldn't be right, looking through that gadget of his and seeing craters. And they said, in spite of seeing those craters themselves through that telescope, they said the craters are filled with an invisible dust, and that really they're not craters there at all. You just don't see that dust. It's invisible and fills the craters. Well, perhaps you can resort to something like that and still get you a few miles of dust on the surface of the moon and work yourself out of the problem. Well, That's one argument. Let me take another short one here, in this regard. There is an effect called the Poynting-Robertson effect that gives an indication of that things might be quite young rather than very old. If you have a little particle that's traveling around the sun in an orbit, the radiation from the sun incident on this particle will do a number of things, perhaps, to this particle. One thing, it sputters it. These astrodynamics people have a term called sputtering, which means if you have radiation on a chunk of rock, say, atoms of that material get knocked loose. They call this sputtering. You see, eventually all the atoms get knocked out of that chunk of rock, and you've got no matter left. And so the thing disintegrates by this effect referred to as sputtering. And this breaks up material quite rapidly. But at the present time, the indications are that it breaks things up very, very rapidly, but no one's sure just how fast. If you have radiation incident on a small particle, this radiation carries momentum, what is called momentum. Momentum is a measure of motion that an object possesses. This radiation carries momentum with it. And when radiation is incident on a surface, it exerts a pressure on that surface. So a little particle has a pressure, which is force per unit area, exerted on it. And this pressure tends to push the particle away from the radiating object. And then there is another effect, and this is an extremely important one. If particles are very, very small, this is the most important effect. See, radiation pressure tends to blow everything out of the solar system, tends to push everything out of the solar system. Sputtering tends to disintegrate everything. And an effect referred to as the Poynting-Robertson, P-O-Y-N-T-I-N-G, Poynting-Robertson effect, tends to pull everything into the sun, tends to cause everything to come into the sun. Now, when radiation comes out of the sun, it possesses momentum, of course, but it does not possess what is called angular momentum, which is motion associated with a rotation about some point, a rotation in an orbit. See, the radiation coming out of the sun comes radially out of the sun in all of the different directions. But it is not a motion that is associated with rotation at all, or is not a measure of motion associated with rotation. Well, when this radiation hits this little particle absorbs the radiation. Then, if the particle is very small, it will re-radiate that radiation. You see that energy that it absorbed very quickly, just nearly in the twinkling of an eye, not quite that fast, but nearly that fast. If it is a very small particle, and we're talking about extremely small particles here, if it is a very small particle, it will re-radiate that energy that it absorbed. As the sunlight hit the particle, it will re-radiate it very, very rapidly in a very short period of time. Now, when it re-radiates that energy that it absorbed, you see the particle is partaking of rotational motion about the sun. It's moving in an orbit nearly circular about the sun. So anything coming out of that small particle any radiation coming out of it is going to have angular momentum, or momentum, you see, associated with a rotational motion. But when the radiation got there, it didn't possess any angular momentum at all. It possessed only a linear momentum or a radial momentum, didn't possess any angular momentum, momentum associated with a rotational motion, and so the little particle supplied the angular momentum to that radiation that's coming out of the particle. Well, when it supplied it to that radiation that comes out of the particle, it had to give up some of its own. Gave up some of its own angular momentum. See, it possessed angular momentum, motion associated with a rotary motion about the sun. It had to give up some of its angular momentum in order to supply that radiation with it, since the radiation possessed none to start with. And in this particular case, momentum has to be conserved. Well, it gives it some of its angular momentum. It loses some of its own. When it gives up some of its own, it slows down a little bit. So the particle has to slow down. It gives up some of its own motion to the radiation coming out of the particle. When it gives up some of that angular momentum, it slows down. But there's gravity pulling on that particle still. Gravity's pulling just as hard as it was ever pulling. And so when it slows down a little bit, the particle does what? Moves in slightly closer to the sun. And the particle is still absorbing radiation, re-radiating it, and this effect continues. And so the particle then gradually and continually slows down in its motion, and gradually and continually then spirals in closer and closer to the sun, eventually getting in so close to the sun that it is vaporized due to the tremendous heat of the sun. This is called the Poynting-Robertson effect. It was discovered by a British physicist by the name of Poynting about 1903, and one physicist said he was wrong, published a paper showing he was wrong. Then later on, in the next issue of the same journal, he published a paper saying, no, he was wrong, Poynting was right after all. And then Poynting had done his work on the basis of classical physics. Later on, the quantum mechanics people, a fellow by the name of Robertson at the California Institute of Technology, published a paper showing that Poynting was right on the basis of a quantum mechanics approach to the problem. And the effect then is well established. Now, the Poynting-Robertson effect says all of your material is going to spiral into the sun eventually. That's of a certain size. If it's larger than that size, it's going to be pushed out of the solar system instead of coming in. If you assume that the orbits are circular to start with for these particles, you can get a very, very simple formula for calculating the length of time that it takes for the particle to spiral in. And the length of time depends on the distance of the particle from the sun squared. The distance of the particle from the sun squared. It depends on the density of the particle and depends on the diameter of the particle. Those are the factors that determine how fast the particle is going to spiral in. It has nothing to do with the quantity of dust or material that you've got present. It has to do with those quantities. The distance of the particle from the sun squared, the density of the particle, how much matter per unit volume the particle contains, and the radius or diameter, whichever one you want to use, of the particle itself. Now, as a matter of fact, I'll give you the formula. Multiply 7 million times the radius of the particle in centimeters, times the density of the particle in grams per cubic centimeter, times the distance of the particle from the sun squared in what we call astronomical units, an astronomical unit being 93 million miles. The Earth is one astronomical unit from the sun. This is one of these do-it-yourself formulas. You can be an expert in the Poynting-Robertson effect on how long it will take things to spiral into the sun with just a simple calculation that you can perform without any real difficulty. Well, if you take a look at these figures, you find that you can sweep practically everything into the sun in times that are far, far smaller than the alleged age of the solar system itself, you know, being 4.5 to 5 billion years. If you go out to the planet Neptune, and you start with everything 6 feet in size, unless you can bring everything in an age, at a length of time, that is far, far less than this 4.5 billion years. Anything of up to 1 centimeter between the Earth and the sun, for instance, you can sweep in just a very short period of time, on the order of just several thousand years. In other words, you can sweep the solar system clean of small particles in just several thousand years. Most of the dust material is believed to be concentrated from the asteroid belt into the sun. You can sweep everything from the asteroid belt into the sun in a length of time that is far, far less than the age of the solar system. So if you pick up astronomy books today, they'll make statements like this. Everything that's small in size must be recent in its formation, because the Poynting-Robertson effect would have long, long ago swept everything into the sun. And there could not possibly be any material between the planets at all, from a few tens of centimeters down, you see, to atomic size, because the Poynting-Robertson effect would have swept it in. By the way, let me point this out very hastily. If you go out to some of the large stars, the O and B stars, you know, that put out about 100,000 times as much energy as the sun does, those stars would, through this Poynting-Robertson effect, sweep material in 100,000 times faster than the sun does. But yet these stars are surrounded by huge clouds of dust and gas. You know, that's why they say these stars, you know, are forming out there in those huge clouds. But these stars would sweep that material in 100,000 times faster than the sun does. Those stars cannot be old at all, cannot be more than just a few thousand years in age, and still have those huge clouds of dust and matter out there. So I think there are quite a number of arguments, and I've cited just a few here in this lecture, that things are quite young. The absence of dust on the Earth, virtual absence of it, the absence of the dust on the Moon, and the Poynting-Robertson effect, because space is still crowded rather heavily or thickly with cosmic dust material. Station break. All right, well, here we are. Ready to go again. I have a little bit more to say about this. I abbreviated my statements there since the things were winding down. I spend all my time on the first point. So I had to hurry through the pointing Robertson effect. This pointing Robertson effect, I didn't get to emphasize it enough there. It's extremely important. You see, you have that huge zodiacal cloud that exists, around the sun about half an astronomical unit from the sun. This thing contains billions and billions and billions of tons of dust and gas, very, very small in size. And so a question that has plagued astronomers for quite a number of years now is how can that dust cloud stay out there with the pointing Robertson effect operating over billions of years? See, those particles out there are atomic in size up to about 10 to the minus 5 centimeters, 100,000th of a centimeter. Well, if you put that in, by the way, at 10 to the minus 5 in that formula I gave you, well, you'll get that dust material in there in a short period of time. So the question arises, how can you keep the zodiacal cloud very long? Well, of course, there are a lot of arguments as to how to replenish it. To keep the zodiacal cloud in existence, you'd have to have at least 20 tons per second being added to the cloud. You know, the pointing Robertson effect is sweeping the material in so rapidly. In order to keep that thing up to its size that it has, as it is observed at the present time, you would have to put 20 tons per second into it. 20 tons of material. That's hard to come by. Of course, in a little bit, I want to talk about the breakup of comets, and there you will have a source, but it doesn't seem that it can remotely supply the zodiacal cloud very long, and certainly you have a hard time putting in 20 tons per second of this material. The pointing Robertson effect produces another effect that I should mention here. When comets travel around the sun, they develop tails. As a matter of fact, from the moment you see them, practically they have a tail. No one's real sure why the tail develops. It's either radiation pressure of sunlight, or it's the solar wind that's blowing everything out of the head of the comet. But anyhow, they have tails. And that material that's in the tails of the comets does not go back to the comet. It's debris that is lost from the comet permanently. And this material distributes itself in the orbit of the comet. And as the comet then swings around the sun and more of this debris is left in its path or in its orbit or its trail, of course, when we intersect that trail in space, we get a meteor shower. And it's believed that meteor showers, you know, are caused by our crossing the trails of this debris you see left from comets. Some places it is very dense and we have a spectacular meteor shower. In other places it is not very dense and you don't have much of a meteor shower. Well, the pointing Robertson effect, in a short period of time, you see, will operate on these meteor trails, and the material that's in closer will be swept in than the material that's farther out along the trail. You see, you have a big trail spread out in a band traveling around the sun. The pointing Robertson effect, you see, operates with a different effect on different parts of that trail. And so what you should do, you should have the smaller material brought to one side of the trail, because you see, the smaller the material, the larger the pointing Robertson effect. You should have a larger material left on the outside of the trail. And so as we pass across a meteor stream, what is called a meteor stream, and observe a meteor shower, we should observe a change in the magnitudes or the brightnesses of the meteors that we observe in the sky during that meteor shower. You see, due to this pointing Robertson effect. You see, you've got a trail of debris. It's a mixture of large and small and all sizes of material coming out of the head of that comet. When the pointing Robertson effect operates, it'll bring the small to one side because it operates with a larger force on the small particles than it does on the large. So you'll have large on one edge of the trail, small on one side, and as our orbit crosses that trail, the Earth passes through what? Small to large, or large to small, whichever way the thing's going. Well, small to large. And so, as you cross that trail and those chunks of rock enter the Earth's atmosphere, causing meteors, as you pass the part of the trail you see, or the orbit that has the debris in it, that has the small particles, you'll have meteors that are not very bright. As you get to the outer edge of the trail, where the large chunks of rock you see are left, due to this sorting effect of the pointing Robertson effect, bringing things in at a different rate, you'll hit the meteors that will cause what? A lot of light in the sky, relatively speaking. So as you cross a trail, you should observe a definite variation in the brightness of the meteors. As a matter of fact, if the
these comets are as old as these people are trying to claim, you should observe a variation of brightness of about 5 magnitudes as you go across a meteor trail or cometary trail that's causing a meteor shower in the sky. And radio astronomers such as old ABC Lovell, or ACB Lovell rather, over in England, he's been looking for this for years. The people in this country who use optical methods and photographic methods more for studying meteors, they've been looking at this, and the report is that there is not this observed variation in brightness at all. Well, listen, it only takes several hundred to a few thousand years to get this material separated out and to get this variation in brightness. As a matter of fact, for a typical meteor stream, it would take only 1 million years to get you a difference in brightness from one edge to the other edge of about 5 magnitudes. But yet this is not observed, has not been observed in a single meteor stream that we have crossed. And that's going from the data that began to be reported in the late 1940s, you know, when radio telescopes and radar telescopes were being used by the people in Great Britain, namely Lovell's crowd, up to the present time. This variation has not at all been observed. So it seems to me then, if the Poynting-Robertson effect is true, and you'd have a hard time finding an astronomer who doesn't believe that it is true because the physics is good, you should have this effect. You cannot have then 1 million years worth of time of operation of that Poynting-Robertson effect on any of these strings. And so how could things be even 1 million years old? Poynting-Robertson effect's going to sweep things in short periods of time. So the Poynting-Robertson effect, it seems to me, argues very, very strongly for a young age to the solar system. Argues certainly strongly for a young age to those meteor streams, which would in turn argue for a young age for the comets. And it argues for a young age for the asteroid belt, because there's nothing much, there couldn't be anything left between here and the sun and the asteroid belt if the Earth is very, very old or the solar system is very, very old. Well, I've used up a lot of time. I suppose I ought to let you ask some questions. I'm going to have to share, let that next lecture be a sharing of radiometric data. I've got more to say about a young age. I've just started my arguments. I've got quite a bit to say, so we'll let things wrap over a little bit. I'm sorry, would you say it one more time? I didn't hear you.
In regards to the influx of cosmic dust, is that measured to be a pretty uniform process?
He says, in regard to the influx of cosmic dust, does it, in the measurements, does it seem to be fairly uniform? In time, you mean? Yes, it does. You get roughly the same values over a period of time. It doesn't vary a great deal. Sometimes you may have a little bit more than others, but over the periods of time this has been done, it's been essentially uniform, yes.
So someone like Hoyle handled this argument for a young astronomer.
Well, I've never heard or read where Hoyle said anything about it particularly. He just doesn't deal with it because he considers that a perfectly absurd position and could not have any validity, so he wouldn't even, I'm sure his reply would be, he wouldn't even honor such a position with even a discussion. When arguments are presented for a young age, they're dismissed as the rantings of crazed, you know, the old mad scientists, a new breed of mad scientists who are off on the wrong track, and ordinarily nothing's even said about these things. Yes, well, all right, yes.
What would happen to the vaporized material due to the
point of Well, it's just atomic material, just the atoms and so forth, which eventually themselves would go into the sun.
Would this add a significant mass to the sun?
Probably not, because the mass of the sun is so very, very large compared to the rest of the solar system put together. Yeah, all the mass is in the sun, practically, so it really wouldn't make any difference. Yes?
From the depth of dust found on the moon, have creationists calculated how old the moon may possibly...
Well, there have been some attempts at it, but you see, the dust is varied considerably in those seas, and so it's hard to arrive at a thickness that you could say this is the actual thickness. You see, there seem to be electric fields that sweep the surface of the moon and would carry dust down into the seas, and so the deposition of this dust has not been so uniform on the moon. So it's rather hard to arrive at a definite number. You can just get a range of values, and the range of values would put the age in the thousands of years. But there's no way to get a definite value. Because in one sea, you have just a small fraction of the thickness of this dust. In another sea, you have Maybe, say, a foot of it or something like that. So it varies considerably depending with the sea. You remember the first landing, he said he scuffed through the dust with his boot. In the second landing, they said, oh, there's a lot of dust here. When they said lot, they just meant compared to the first sea, they didn't mean a lot of dust. It was still just two fractions of an inch, really. First one was about an eighth of an inch or something like that. Yes.
The surveyors or any of the satellites collect any dust on the moon?
Do any of the satellites, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
The moon in any way collected or arranged the amount
of... Influx of it. Oh, there's been some talk about it. There was an article published recently on influx, but it was a very unsatisfactory study. They were saying there was some influx, but they cited some numbers, but it was a very unsatisfactory approach. So there's attempts at doing this, yes. By the way, when I said a while ago, he who laughs last, laughs best in this, if you take the satellite data, you see, satellites are out far enough, you're not going to have any contamination from in your trays, from Smog Incorporated or anything. If you've got a satellite whizzing around the Earth, all you have to do is put a little sensing device in that thing, and if it collides with a small particle, you get a signal generated. And on the strength of that signal, you can calculate the kinetic energy of the particle. And if you have some idea of the density of the particle, the mass of the particle, the velocity of the particle, you can get the mass of the particle. So you can get the distribution of sizes and quantities of these particle material in space. And by the way, the satellite data gives about the same answer, roughly, that the people were getting, you know, when they put out those trays. Nobody much is working with the trays anymore. That's a thing of the past. That's why I do it with satellites out there, counting these particles and getting those densities very, very nicely without any worry about looking under microscopes to be sure you got... What are you hitting when you're out there? You're surely not hitting a speck of iron that's spewed out of some smokestack of a factory 1,000 miles above the surface of the Earth. At least nobody thinks you are. Who knows? Maybe they've squirted it all up there. But nobody believes that you're getting anything up there that's from some factory down here at a height like that, or 5,000 miles from the surface of the Earth, or something like that. So today, practically everything comes from the satellite data rather than coming from the setting these trays out. Nobody does that anymore. That's a relic of the past. Yes.
If you don't go with theories of plate tectonics and time and drift, do you have alternate theories for phenomena such as, earthquakes,
Oh, nobody knows what really causes earthquakes. The plate tectonic crowd don't know either. They just talked about the sliding of plates. I don't know whether plates are sliding or not. The evidence is not clear, really.
If they are, would that be a
seismic? Well, certainly you get seismic activity if those plates are moving around. Yes, you can get earthquake activity.
But would it be a seismic explanation if the theory was valid?
No, it's not, because if the plate, if for instance, the plate of rock under the Pacific Ocean is sliding under the California coast, the continents there under the California coast, you don't have enough seismic activity there, although you've got a lot. But you don't have enough. Plate tectonics, you should be having a lot more if the plates are really sliding.
My question was, if the theory is valid, would that be an explanation for the deposition of the continent?
Oh, no. That's why I mentioned it. Still, I don't think it affects the argument dealing with the cosmic dust, because I don't see how you slide the nickel under continents. So I don't see how you can slide soft sediments under hard sediments. Suppose you take a piece of pie, try to slide that under a table, under a piece of wood. Oh, my goodness, what happens to the soft piece of pie? Well, it just gets mashed up, as you try to slide that under something hard. So what you're doing, you're trying to slide relatively soft rock under, relatively speaking, very hard rock. And it seems to me all you get is a bulldozer type effect for your sediments tend to heap up in front of the thing you're trying to slide. Yes?
On that, I saw an article a couple of years ago in Scientific American that they try to explain that, but their orders of magnitude are several orders difference. Like they talk about 100 million years, whereas you're still talking about 8,000. So even if it were a partial explanation, it wouldn't come anywhere near large enough.
All right, yes. Yes.
On this lack of observed variation in the brightness of that comet tail, does that make the comet tail?
Well, no, not the comet tail as such. Certainly in a comet, there's variation brightnesses within it. But I mean, after the debris that's left over, which is no longer considered to be associated with the comet itself. See, for instance, when we go through a meteor shower called the Andromedids, just to take a case, when we cross the region of space that stream of debris is moving, we do not observe the predicted variation in the light of these meteors that should be there if the Poynting-Robertson effect has been operating, say, for a million years. Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. Now, within a comet itself, you've got a great deal of variation in the parts of the brightness of a comet itself. You look at the head of the comet, you have a different brightness. You look at what is called the nucleus of the comet, you have a different brightness from the head of the comet. If you look at the tail of the comet, you have still a different brightness from the other parts. But no, I'm talking about the debris. See, most astronomers believe that the debris that's involved in causing these meteor showers is just the debris coming out of a comet in the past. Now, that's hard to establish, though. That's not as simple as it sounds. That sounds like a reasonable answer. But there have only been about three or four, at the very most, meteor showers that have definitely been established as associated with comets in the past. And there is the British astronomer Davidson, who doesn't believe that most of those meteor showers are associated with comets. But if they are associated with comets, and you have this debris, you know, in the orbit, Poynting-Robertson effect would widen it, you see. That's what I'm saying, it would widen it, because it'll bring the small material in quicker than it'll bring the large material. So you've got an inner boundary and an outer boundary to it. Both boundaries are continually moving in. The whole thing is continually moving in. But the inner is smaller. The smaller material is coming in faster than the larger material. And so as our orbit crosses that orbit, you see, we'll go from one edge of the band to the other edge of the band. We should observe a variation in the brightness of these objects. Yes?
What kind of objections do you get to the use of this Poynting-Robertson effect?
He says, what sort of objections does one get in mentioning the Poynting-Robertson effect, right? Okay. Well, I don't know for sure, because I've never heard anybody say anything in particular. I remember I said this up at that college in East Lansing, you know, that I mentioned in my lecture. And the fellow there who taught astronomy, he said he'd never heard of the Poynting-Robertson effect. But that was all right. It was okay with me. He'd never heard of it. It showed that he wasn't keeping up with the latest. No, it's an old effect. Poynting published it in 1903. The paper's published then. Philosophical Transactions. And Robertson about the 1930s with his quantum mechanics. I mean, it's a common knowledge. It's not a hidden... This Poynting-Robertson effect is not something that's hidden. Physicists rarely work with it because it's not something you deal with in the laboratory. It's something that astronomers are interested in. But it's very well known. Well, I'll tell you where I first saw it really mentioned and the implications of it was by this fellow, Henry Norris Russell. You know that I mentioned yesterday, old Hertzsprung Russell. Russell of Hertzsprung Russell fame. Russell wrote a little paper back in the 30s in Scientific American. He wrote a little short paper on the Poynting-Robertson effect. And he explained how it was operating. And he said that you could sweep the solar system clean in less than 2 billion years. See, back then they were saying 2 billion years for the age of things. And Russell was saying, how can the universe then, or the Earth, you know, solar system, be 2 billion years old if we still got a lot of this stuff? Well, Russell believed it, but Russell was a great one for pointing out dilemmas, and he always liked to say, here's a dilemma. And he said, here's a dilemma. The Poynting-Robertson effect will sweep the solar system clean of any kind of material of reasonable size in less than 2 billion years, clear out to the orbit of Neptune. And he explained how the thing operated and so forth. He had a rather complicated explanation. You may have thought mine was complicated, but his more complicated than mine, even, on how it operated. But, and he said, the solar system obviously is not clean. It is crowded, relatively speaking, with this material. And he says, how can we reconcile this, you see, with an age of 2 billion years, which the geologist has told us about the age of the Earth? Well, if you pick up astrophysics textbooks, you'll find a mention of the Poynting-Robertson effect, but you'll find the out that I mentioned to you. These people will say the Poynting-Robertson effect will sweep this in a short period of time. Therefore, everything that is of such and such size must be recent in origin. This is the statement. See, that is the avenue of escape. They will just say, well, this is very recent and is not something that is very old. But, of course, then if you do that, you have to find a source for this recent material. I'll have more comments on that when I take up the breakup of comets and so forth, which I'm going to in the next lecture, or the one this afternoon that I have. Yes.
Is there any speculation as to where the asteroid belt came from?
Yes, there's a great deal of speculation on it. The popular view, the romantic one, so to speak, has been that there was a planet out there between Mars and Jupiter. See, Bode's law, whether it's really a law or not, nobody knows. But anyhow, that little mathematical formula called the Titus-Bode law predicts the existence of a planet between Mars and Jupiter. There's not one there, but there's what's called the asteroid belt. Some people say that the asteroids are the result of some kind of breakup of a large planet that existed between Mars and Jupiter. That's very hard, though, to prove. Practically impossible to prove. You see, if it happened in the past, how do you prove that something exploded there? And of course, then, how do you explode a planet? Now, that's really something. See, these things sound good, but let me tell you, it's no mean chore to explode a planet and to break it up into fragments. That's something else to be able to do that. And people have speculated all the way from some kind of nuclear reaction occurring in a planet, and that's hard to understand. I don't know what all. But you have all sorts of speculations about how it could have happened. But there's no real proof that it happened in the first place. And the reason they say it happened, though, is that Titus-Bode law. But a lot of astronomers don't believe that means anything anyway. Some believe it does. Who knows? I haven't the slightest idea whether it means anything for sure or not. But yes, there's a lot of speculation that that happened. And of course, the folks who follow, you know, Velikovsky have made a great deal of such a thing as this. Maybe it did happen. I don't know. Yes.
Have an older age?
This gentleman says, is there any evidence that those particles that they say are newly formed have an age fairly old? Is that right? Yes. Yeah. All right. He says, is there any evidence that they are really just newly formed, or could they be old? Well, it's really very difficult to ever decide that. If you pick up some of this material, these people will try to date it, you know, using radiometric methods. But they're giving very, very unsatisfactory values. So, no, to my knowledge, there's been no real attempt to establish that. Yes.
Grounding your first argument, the uniformitarian.
Yes, because you see, here's my approach. And I think this is a valid approach. If you have a position that is advanced, then you to decide whether it is true or not, you try to falsify it some way or other. So you assume, all right, it is true. Let's take its assumption, or rather its predictions, and take the model and assume that it is true and see if it leads to any contradictions or an illogical position. So yes, I'm saying, all right, assume these fellows are right about this. Then if we work backwards, we come to this difficulty. Therefore, their position is not correct. Yes, that's the approach I'm using. Sure, that would change the whole picture. Don't have what? Well, that may be true, yes. That makes what?
That may explain why we don't have a hint of the presence of the planet.
Well, of course, I guess one could say he'd get rid of nickel some way or other like that. It's a possibility. But, true. Well, I won't argue so much with that position. But if you go to the moon, certainly there, you've got the thing rather well wrapped up. Maybe one can always, he can always argue that he squeezed this nickel under the continents. I don't really see how he could do it, but a lot of people seem to think that's an out anyhow, you know. I don't really think it is. Physically, I don't see how it could be done myself. But when you got to go to the moon, there you don't have to worry about all of you shifting around. But yes, my approach has been, let's assume the evolutionist is right, work backwards then, and if his position, see if it is contradictory at all. Yes.
You're talking about shoving soft material under hard material.
Uh-huh.
At the depth of, say, 50 miles, the temperature is very high. This so-called hard rock is quite soft, that temperature, would it not?
Well, there's a lot of question as to whether how soft it is down there. Earthquakes have been recorded at depths as much as 700 kilometers, so it can't be very soft. Because you can't have an earthquake in soft rock, because the energy must be released very suddenly. And if it is soft rock or can flow very easily, then elastic potential energy will not accumulate, because it will continue to be released in soft material. Yes.
How is this account for very thin ocean sediments near the mid-Atlantic ridge, and thicker and thicker sediments that you get away from. The material, the mantle material, is not moving up and outward.
Oh, there may have been some movement. Certainly, where you have volcanic action, you get movement. And there your rocks are in a fluid state. But you can't have an earthquake generated in lava, for instance. You won't have an earthquake in lava. You can only have earthquakes occurring in solid or hard rock. There's just no way you can keep the energy there to have an earthquake form. You can have earthquakes formed as a result of volcanic action, but you don't have an earthquake occurring in lava-type rock or soft rock.
Atlantic Ridge is thousands of miles long. It seems to be
sure, yes.
Movement from this
well, certainly the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, at least to me, is a beautiful case of a tremendous catastrophic happening there, because you have a huge mass of igneous rock that apparently has changed the flow of the ocean in that vicinity, and as you say, certainly extends around the globe. But if within soft rock, you do not have earthquakes formed. You may have earthquakes formed as a result of movement of soft rock against hard rock, for instance, but there is no way in soft rock itself to generate an earthquake. And one can talk about rocks being nearly fluid at great depth, but earthquakes have been measured at 700 kilometers, for instance, and the rock can't be soft or in a fluid state, or you can't get an earthquake. You have to have it in solid rock, or the rock will continually liberate its energy. Yes?
Delicacy has been so helpful to undermine the uniformitarian position, but how do the creationists best handle this?
Well, my feeling is that is, as you say, Velikovsky has accumulated a great deal of evidence for catastrophic action. Yet I feel that many of his explanations as to how these catastrophes occurred are not correct. I don't think he has his physics is correct about some of the orbits and runaway planets and so forth that he talks about. Though my position is, use the evidence that Velikovsky has accumulated. Make use of any evidence that you can get for catastrophism. But so far as my position is concerned, I think he is wrong about the reasons that he has cited for some of these catastrophic happenings. But the evidence, certainly, use any evidence you can get your hands on if it is good evidence. Yes?
Your comment on Patton's catastrophic...
Well, Patton is attempting to Christianize Velikovsky. Velikovsky wants in no way to be associated with any Christian groups. He does not want his doings associated with Creation Research Society in any way. I suspect the feeling is somewhat mutual in that regard, except for the evidence business, as I mentioned. Patton is a follower of Velikovsky, really, but he wants to sort of change a few things, and he wants to somehow or other get the Christian position associated with Velikovsky's ideas and findings and thoughts. Velikovsky will not mention such terms as B.C. and A.D. because he wants no reference to Christ whatsoever, and he makes this very plain. And so I think Patton is attempting to Christianize Velikovsky's position. Patton is a very sincere man. I disagree with him, though. I think, again, his physics is wrong in much of what he's saying. He's a very fine man, as far as I know, and I don't mean that in any bad way, but I disagree with Patton's position myself.